to be handling a clue. He promised a full investigation of the unfortunate Stanley after the testing. Since Mark had no need to participate in the testing, Julian asked him if he would look after Tavi in the library. "I will not feed him to a tree, as is done in the unseelie court with unruly children," Mark promised.
"That's a relief," Julian said dryly.
Mark bent down toward Tavi, whose eyes were sparkling.
"Come with me, little one," Mark said. "There are books in the library that I remember, that I loved as a child. I could show them to you."
Tavi nodded and placed his hand in Mark's with total trust. Something went through Mark's eyes then, a lightning flash of emotion. He went out of the room with Tavi without another word. Cameron's warning stayed with Emma through the rest of the meal, as they cleaned up, and after they all filed to the classroom to find Diana there, holding a heavy stack of testing papers. She couldn't get his words off her mind, and as a result scored dismally on languages and memorization of the classes of various demons and downworlders. She mixed up Azazel and Asmodeus, Pergatic and Thonian, and Nixies and Pixies. Diana glared at her as she marked the paper with Emma's name on it with a fat red pen. Everyone else scored high, and the few that Julian missed were ones Emma suspected he had gotten wrong on purpose to make her feel better. Emma was grateful when they finished up the written and oral parts of the test. They took a break for lunch before moving down the hall to the training room. Diana had already set up the space. There were targets for knife throwing, swords of various sizes, and in the middle of the room, a large training dummy. It had a wooden trunk, several arms that could be positioned and repositioned, and a stuffed cloth head like a scarecrow. A circle of black and white powder surrounded the dummy, rock salt mixed with ash. "Attacking from a distance, with care and precision," Diana said. "Disrupt the ash circle and you fail." She moved toward the black box on the floor and flipped a switch. It was a radio. Noise exploded into the room, harsh and discordant. It sounded as if someone had recorded a mob in action, shouting and yelling and smashing windows. Livy looked horrified. Ty winced and reached for his headphones, dropping them over his ears. "Distraction," said Diana loudly. "You have to work past it." Before she could finish, there was a knock at the door. It was Mark, looking diffident.
"Tavi is busy with his books," he said to Diana, who had reached to turn the noise down slightly. "And you had asked if I could join this part of the testing. I thought it best to oblige."
"But Mark doesn't need to be tested," objected Julian. "It's not as if his scores can be reported to the Clave."
"Christina doesn't need her scores reported either," Diana said. "But she's joining in. I want to see how you all do. If you're going to work together, it would be best if you all knew each other's skill levels."
"I can fight," Mark said. He didn't add anything about the night before, the fact that he'd held off mantid demons on his own without new runes.
"The Wild Hunt are warriors."
"Yes, but they fight differently than shadow hunters," Diana said, gesturing around the training room at the runed blades, the Adamas swords.
"These are the weapons of your people." She turned back to the others. "Each of you must choose one."
Mark's expression flattened at that, but he said nothing. Nor did he move as the rest of them scattered. Emma went for Cortana, Christina for her butterfly knives, Livy for her saber, and Drew for a long, thin misericord. Julian chose a pair of chakrams, circular razor throwing stars.
Ty hung back.
Emma couldn't help but wonder if Diana noticed that it was Livy who picked up a dagger for Ty and pressed it into his palm. Emma had seen Ty throw knives before. He was good at it, sometimes excellent, but only when he felt like it. When he didn't, there was no moving him.
"Julian," Diana said, turning the music back up, "you first."
Julian stepped back and threw, the chakrams spinning from his hands like circles of light. One sheared off the training dummy's right arm, and the other its left, before they buried themselves in the wall.
"Your target isn't dead," Diana pointed out, "just armless."
"Exactly," said Julian. "So I can question him. Or it. You know, if it's a demon."
"Very strategic."
Diana tried to hide a smile as she made a note in her book. She picked up the dummy's arms and fastened them back on.
"Livy?"
Livy dispatched the dummy with a swing of her saber without passing the ash barrier. Drew acquitted herself decently with the thrown misericord, and Christina flipped open her Bali songs and hurled them so that one point of each blade stuck into the dummy's head, exactly where its eyes would have been.
"Gross," said Livy admiringly.
I like it. Christina retrieved her knives and winked at Emma, who had climbed partway up the rope ladder, Cortana in her free hand. Emma, Diana said, craning her head up, what are you doing? Emma flung herself from the ladder. It wasn't the cold fury of battle, but there was a moment of falling freedom that was pure pleasure, that drove the annoyance of Cameron's warning out of her mind. She landed on the dummy, feet planted on its shoulders, and slashed down, driving Cortana's hilt deep into its trunk. Then she flipped herself backward over and down, landing on her feet inches outside the circle of ash. That was showing off, Diana said, but she was smiling as she made another note. She glanced up. Tiberius, it's your turn. Ty took a step toward the circle. The white band of his headphones was stark against his black hair. He was as tall as the dummy, Emma realized with a jolt. She often thought of Ty as the child he had been, but he wasn't. He was 15 years old, older than she'd been when she and Julian had undergone the parabatai ceremony. His face wasn't a little boy's face anymore. Sharpness had replaced the softness. Ty lifted his knife. Tiberius, said a voice from the doorway. Take the headphones off. It was Uncle Arthur. They all looked up in surprise. Arthur rarely ventured downstairs, and when he did, he avoided conversation, meals, all contact. It was strange to see him hovering in the doorway like a gray ghost. Gray robe, gray stubble, worn gray pants. The pollution of mundane technology is everywhere, said Arthur. In those phones you carry. Cars, at the London Institute, we didn't own them. That computer you think I don't know about. An odd anger flashed across his face. You're not going to be able to go into battle wearing headphones. He said the word as if it were poisonous. Diana closed her eyes. Ty, she said, take them off. Ty slid the headphones down so they hung around the back of his neck. He winced as the chatter of noise and voices from the radio struck his ears. I won't be able to do it then. Then you'll fail, said Arthur. This has to be fair. If you don't let him use them, it won't be fair, said Emma. This is the test. Everyone has to do it, Diana said. Battle doesn't always happen under optimum conditions. There's noise, blood, distractions. I won't be in battle, Ty said. I don't want to be that kind of shadow hunter. Tiberius, Arthur said sharply. Do as you're asked. Ty's face set. He lifted the knife and threw it, with deliberate awkwardness but great force. It slammed into the black plastic radio, which shattered into 100 pieces. There was silence. Ty looked down at his right hand. It was bleeding. A piece of the shattered radio had gone wide and nicked his skin. Scowling, he went to stand by one of the pillars. Levy watched him with miserable eyes. Julian made as if to start after him when Emma caught him by the wrist. Don't, she said. Give him a minute. My turn, said Mark. Diana turned toward him in surprise. He was already stalking toward the training dummy. He strode directly up to it, his boots scuffing the ash and salt on the ground. Mark, Diana said, you're not supposed to... He caught hold of the dummy and yanked it toward himself, ripping the stuffed head from its body. Straw rained down around him. He tossed the head aside, seized hold of the attached arms, and bent them back until they snapped. He took a step back, planted his foot in the middle of the thing's trunk, and shoved. It went over with a crash. It would almost have been funny, Emma thought, if not for the look on his face. These are the weapons of my people, he said, holding out his hands. A cut on the right one had opened and was bleeding. You weren't supposed to touch the circle, said Diana. Those are the rules, and I don't make them. The clave. Lex mala, lex nulla, Mark said coldly and walked away from the dummy. Emma heard Arthur draw in his breath at the words of the Blackthorne family motto. He turned without a word and stalked out of the room. Julian's eyes tracked his brother as Mark went toward Ty and leaned against the pillar beside him. Ty, who had been holding his right hand with his left, his jaw set, looked up in surprise. Mark. Mark touched his younger brother's hand gently, and Ty did not pull away. They both had the Blackthorne fingers, long and delicate, with sharp, articulated bones. Slowly the angry look faded from Ty's face. Instead, he looked sideways up at his brother, as if the answer to a question Emma couldn't guess at could be read in Mark's face. She remembered what Ty had said about his brother in the library. It's not his fault if he doesn't understand everything, or if things are too much for him. It's not his fault. Now we both have hurt hands, Mark said.
Julian, Diana said, we need to talk about Ty.
Julian stood motionless in front of her desk. You could see past Diana, past the huge glass windows behind her, down to the highway and the beach below and the ocean beyond that. He held a very clear memory in his mind, though he no longer remembered how old he had been when it happened. He'd been on the beach, sketching the sun going down and the surfers out in the water. A loose sketch, more about the joy of movement than about getting the picture right. Ty had been there too, playing. He had been building a row of small, perfect squares of damp sand, each exactly the same size and shape. Julian had looked at his own inexact, messy work and Ty's methodical rows and thought, we both see the same world, but in a different way. Ty feels the same joy I do, the joy of creation. We feel all the same things, only the shapes of our feelings are different.
This was Arthur's fault, said Julian. I don't know why he did that. He knew he sounded troubled. He couldn't help it. Usually on Arthur's bad days, his hate and anger were turned inward toward himself. He wouldn't have thought his uncle even knew of Ty's headphones. He didn't think Arthur paid attention to any of them enough to notice such things, and to Ty least of all. I don't know why he treated Ty that way. We can be cruelest to those who remind us of ourselves.
Ty is not like Arthur, Julian's voice sharpened. And he shouldn't have to pay for what Arthur does. You should let him do the test again with the headphones.
Not necessary, Diana said. I know what Ty can do. I'll amend his test scores to reflect that. You don't have to worry about the clave.
Julian looked at her, puzzled. If this isn't about Ty's scores, why did you want to see me?
You heard what Ty said in there, Diana said. He doesn't want to be that kind of shadow hunter. He wants to go to the Scholomance. It's why he refuses to be parabatai with Livy. And you know he'd do almost anything for her.
Ty and Livy were in the computer room now, searching for whatever they could find on Stanley Wells. Ty seems to have put his anger at the testing aside, had even smiled after Mark had come to talk to him. Julian wondered if it was wrong to feel irrationally jealous that Mark, who had reappeared in their life only yesterday, was able to talk to his younger brother when he was not. Julian loved Ty more than he loved his own life, and yet he hadn't thought of anything as elegantly simple to say to his brother as, now we both have hurt hands.
He can't go, Julian said. He's only 15. The other students are 18 at least. It's meant for academy graduates.
He's as smart as any academy graduate, Diana said. He knows as much.
She leaned forward, elbows on her glass desk. Behind her, the ocean stretched to the horizon. It was creeping toward late afternoon, and the water was a dark silver blue. Julian thought about what would happen if he brought his hand down hard on the desk. Did he have the strength to shatter the glass?
It's not about what he knows, Julian said and stopped himself. He was getting dangerously close to exactly what they never talked about, the way in which Ty was different.
Julian often thought the clave was a black shadow over his life. They had stolen his older brother and sister from him, just as much as the fair folk had. Down through the centuries, the exact way shadow hunters could and should behave had been strictly regimented. Tell a mundane about the shadow world and be disciplined, even exiled. Fall in love with the mundane or your parabatai and have your marks ripped off, an agonizing process not everyone survived. Julian's art, his father's interest in the classics, all had been regarded with deep suspicion. Shadow hunters weren't meant to have outside interests. Shadow hunters weren't artists. They were warriors, born and bred like Spartans, and individuality was not something they valued. Ty's thoughts, his beautiful, curious mind, were not like everyone else's. Julian had heard stories, whispers really, of other shadow hunter children who thought or felt differently, who had trouble focusing, who claimed letters rearranged themselves on the page when they tried to read them, who fell prey to dark sadnesses that seemed to have no reason, or fits of energy they couldn't control. Whispers were all there were, though, because the clave hated to admit that Nephilim like that existed. They were disappeared into the dregs portion of the academy, trained to stay out of the way of other shadow hunters, sent to far corners of the globe like shameful secrets to be hidden. There were no words to describe shadow hunters whose minds were shaped differently,
No real words to describe differences at all. Because if there were words, Julian thought, there would have to be acknowledgement. And there were things the Clave refused to acknowledge.
They'll make him feel like there's something wrong with him, Julian said. There's nothing wrong with him.
I know that.
Diana sounded sorrowful, tired. Julian wondered where she had gone the day before, when they'd been at Malcolm's. Who had helped her ward the convergence?
They'll try to force him into their mold of what a shadow hunter ought to be.
He doesn't know what they'll do.
Because you haven't told him, Diana said. If he has a rosy picture in his mind of what the Skolomance is like, it's because you've never corrected him.
Yeah, it's harsh there. It's brutal.
Tell him so.
You want me to tell him he's different, Julian said coldly.
He's not stupid, Diana. He knows that.
No, said Diana, standing up. I want you to tell him how the clay feels about people who are different.
Shadow hunters who are different.
Because how can he make up his mind if he doesn't have all the information?
He's my little brother, Julian snapped.
The day outside was hazy. Parts of the windows seemed mirrored, and he could see bits of himself, an edge of cheekbone, a set jaw, tangled hair. The look in his own eyes frightened him.
He's 3 years from graduation.
Diana's brown eyes were fierce.
I know you've basically brought him up since he was 10, Julian. I know you feel like all of them are your children, and they are yours, but Livy and Ty at least aren't children anymore. You're going to have to let go.
You're telling me to be more forthcoming? Julian demanded.
Really?
Her jaw tightened.
You're walking the edge of a razor blade, Julian, with everything you hide.
Believe me, I've walked that razor blade half my life. You get used to it. So used to it sometimes you forget that you're bleeding.
I don't suppose you want to be any more specific about that?
You have your secrets. I have mine.
I can't believe this. Julian wanted to yell, punch a wall. Keeping secrets is all you ever do. Remember when I asked you if you wanted to run the Institute? Remember when you said no and told me not to ask why?
Diana sighed and ran one finger along the back of her chair.
Being angry at me won't help anything, Jules.
You might be right, he said, but that's the thing you could have done that would probably really have helped me. And you didn't. So forgive me if I feel like I'm in this totally alone.
I love Ty, God believe me. And I want him to have what he wants.
But say I told Ty how harsh the Skolomance was, and he wanted to go anyway.
Could you promise me that he'd be fine there?
Could you swear he and Livy would be all right, separated when they've never spent a day apart in their whole lives? Can you guarantee it?
She shook her head. She looked defeated, and Julian felt no sense of triumph.
I could tell you there are no guarantees in life, Julian Blackthorne, but I can already see you don't want to hear anything I say about Ty, she said.
So I'll tell you something else instead. You may be the most determined person I've ever known. For 5 years you have kept everything and everyone in this house together in a way I wouldn't have thought was possible.
She looked directly at him.
But this situation can't hold. It's like a fault line in the earth. It will break apart under pressure, and then what?
What will you lose? What will we lose when that happens?
What is this? Mark asked, picking up Tavi's stuffed lemur, Mr. Limpet, and holding it gingerly by 1 foot. Mark was sitting on the floor of the computer room with Emma, Tavi, and Drew. Drew had a book called Danse Macabre in one hand and was ignoring them. Tavi was trying to get Mark, wet-haired and barefoot, to play with him. Christina hadn't yet returned from changing out of training clothes. Ty and Livy, meanwhile, were manning the desk. Ty was typing, and Livy was sitting on the desk beside the keyboard, issuing orders and suggestions. Stanley Wells had turned out to have an unlisted address, and Emma strongly suspected that whatever they were doing to try to track it down was probably illegal.
Here, Emma said, reaching out to Mark. Give me Mr. Limpet.
She was feeling anxious and unsettled. Diana had wrapped up the testing shortly after Arthur had left and had called Julian to her office. The way he'd thrown his testing gear into a corner of the training room before following her had made Emma think it wasn't an interview he was looking forward to.
Christina came into the room, running her fingers through her long, wet black hair.
Mark, holding out Mr. Limpet to Emma, looked up, and there was a tearing sound. The lemur's leg came away, and its body thumped to the ground, scattering stuffing. Mark said something in an unrecognizable language.
"You killed Mr. Limpet,"
said Tavi. I think he died of old age, Tavs, said Emma, picking at the stuffed lemur's body. You've had him since you were born.
Or gangrene, Drusilla said, looking at it from her book. It could have been gangrene.
Oh, no, Christina's eyes were wide. Wait here, I'll be right back. Don't, Mark began, but Christina had already hurried from the room. I'm a clodpole, he said mournfully. He reached to ruffle Tavi's hair. I'm sorry, little one.
Did you get an address for Wells?
It was Julian striding into the room. Livy held up her arms in triumph.
Yep, it's in the Hollywood Hills.
No surprise there, Emma said. Rich people often lived in the hills. She was fond of the area herself, despite the expensiveness of the neighborhood. She liked the twisty roads, the massive sprays of flowers climbing over walls and down the sides of houses, and the views out over the electric, lit-up city. At night, the air that blew through the hills smelled like white flowers, oleander and honeysuckle and a dry promise of the desert, miles away.
There are 16 people named Stanley Wells in the greater Los Angeles area, said Ty, swinging his chair around. We narrowed the possibilities down.
Good work, Julian said as Tavi sprang up and came over to him.
Mr. Limpet died, Tavi said, tugging on Julian's jeans.
Jules reached down and lifted him up in his arms.
Sorry, kiddo, Julian said, putting his chin down on Tavi's curls. We'll get you something else.
I'm a murderer, said Mark gloomily. Don't be dramatic, Emma whispered, kicking his bare ankle.
Mark looked cross.
Fairies are dramatic. It's what we do.
I loved Mr. Limpet, said Tavi. He was a good lemur.
There are lots of other good animals, Tiberius spoke earnestly. Animals were one of his favorite subjects, along with detectives and crime. Tavi smiled at him, his face full of trust and love.
Foxes are smarter than dogs. You can hear lions roar from 40 kilometers away. Penguins?
And bears, Christina said, reappearing breathlessly in the doorway. She handed Tavi a stuffed gray bear. He looked at it dubiously. That was mine when I was a little girl, she explained.
What's its name? Tavi inquired.
Oso, said Christina and shrugged. It means bear, in Spanish. I was not very creative.
Oso.
Tavi took the bear and smiled a gap-toothed smile. Julian looked at Christina as if she'd brought him water in the desert. Emma thought of what Livy had said about Jules and Christina in the training room and felt a small, inexplicable sting at her heart. Livy was chattering away to Jules, swinging her legs cheerfully.
So we should all go, she said. Ty and I can go in the car with Emma and Mark, and you can go with Christina, and Diana can stay here.
Julian set his little brother down. Nice try, he said, but this really is a two-person job. Emma and I will be in and out fast, see if there's anything unusual about the house, that's it.
We never get to do anything fun, protested Livy.
I should be allowed to examine the house, Ty said. You'll miss everything important, all the clues.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, Julian said dryly. Look, Livs, Ty, we really need you here to go over the photos from the Convergence Cave. See if you can identify the languages, translate them.
More translating, Livy said, sounds thrilling.
It will be fun, Christina said. We can make hot chocolate and work in the library.
She smiled, and Julian shot her a second grateful look.
It's not busy work, Julian promised. It's because you guys can genuinely do things we can't.
He nodded toward the computer. Livy flushed, and Ty looked pleased.
Mark, however, didn't.
I should go with you, he said to Jules. The courts wished me to be a part of the investigation, to accompany you.
Julian shook his head.
Not tonight. We need to figure out what to do about not being able to use runes on you.
I don't need them, Mark began.
You do, and there was steel in Julian's voice.
You need glamour runes if you want to blend in. And you're still injured from last night. Even if you do heal quickly, I saw you reopened your wound in the training room. You were bleeding.
My blood is not your concern, Mark said.
It is, said Julian. That's what it means to be family.
Family, Mark began bitterly, and then seemed to realize that his younger siblings were there and were looking at him, silent and still. Christina, too, was quiet, gazing at Emma across the room, her gaze dark and worried. Mark seemed to swallow back whatever he had been about to say. If I'd wanted to take orders, I would have stayed with the hunt, he said instead in a low voice, and walked out the door. 11. A Maiden There Lived.
I think Ty's doubled up on his detective reading, Julian said with a smile.
He had his window cranked down, and the air blowing into the car lifted his curling hair off his forehead. He asked me if I thought the killings were an inside job.
Inside what?
Emma smiled. She was leaning back in the passenger seat of the car, her booted feet up on the dashboard. The windows were open to the night, and Emma could hear the sounds of the city rising all around them as they idled at a red light. They had turned up Sunset off the coast highway. At first, as they wound through the canyons and into Beverly Hills and Bel Air, the suburbs were quiet, but they had moved into the heart of Hollywood now. The Sunset Strip, lined with expensive restaurants and massive 100-foot-high billboards plastered with ads for movies and TV shows. The streets were crowded and noisy, tourists posing for photos with celebrity imitators, street musicians collecting change, pedestrians hurrying back and forth from work. Julian seemed more at ease than he had in the past few days, leaning back in his seat, his hands casual on the wheel. Emma knew exactly how he felt. Here, in gear jacket and jeans, with Julian beside her and Cortana in the trunk, she felt like she belonged. Emma had tried to bring up Mark briefly when they had first settled into the car. Julian had only shaken his head and said, "He's getting adjusted," and that was all. She sensed he didn't want to talk about Mark, and that was fine. She didn't know that she had any solutions to offer, and it was easy, so easy, to slip back into their normal joking banter. I think he was asking if I thought the killer was a shadow hunter. Traffic was gathering as they reached the intersection of Sunset and Vine, and the car rolled slowly under the palm trees and neon. I said no, it was obviously someone who knew magic, and I didn't think a shadow hunter would hire a warlock to murder for them. Mostly we do our own murdering. Emma giggled. You told them shadow hunters are DIY about their killing? We're DIY about everything. The traffic started up again. Emma glanced down, watching the play of muscle and tendon in Jules's hand as he shifted gears. The car slid forward, and Emma glanced out the window at the people in line at Grauman's Chinese Theater. She wondered idly what they would think if they knew the two teenagers in the Toyota were actually demon hunters, with a trunk full of crossbows, pole arms, daggers, katanas, and throwing knives. "Everything all right with Diana?" Emma asked. She wanted to talk about Ty. Julian's voice was even, but Emma saw him swallow. He wants so badly to go to the Scholomance and study. They have access to the libraries of the Spiral Labyrinth, the Silent Brothers' archives. I mean, I think of everything we don't know about runes and rituals, the mysteries and puzzles he could solve. But at the same time... He'd be the youngest person there, said Emma. That would be hard on anyone. Ty's only ever been with us. She touched Julian's wrist lightly. I'm glad I never went to the academy. And the Scholomance is supposed to be much harder and lonelier. Some of the students have wound up failing out with, well, Clary called it nervous breakdowns. I think it's a mundane term. Julian glanced down at the GPS and made a left turn, heading up toward the hills. How often do you talk to Clary these days?
About once a month.
Clary had been calling her to check on her ever since they'd first met in Idris when Emma was 12. It was one of the few things Emma didn't talk about much with Jules. The conversations with Clary felt like something that belonged just to her.
Is she still with Jace?
Emma laughed, feeling her tension drain. Clary and Jace were an institution, a legend. They belonged together.
Who'd break up with him?
I might, if he was insufficiently attentive to my needs.
Well, she doesn't talk about her love life to me. But yeah, they're still together. If they broke up, I might have to stop believing in love entirely.
I didn't know you did believe in love, said Jules and paused as if he realized what he'd said.
That came out wrong.
Emma was indignant.
Just because I wasn't in love with Cameron...
You weren't? Traffic sped up. The car lurched forward. Julian struck the wheel with the heel of his palm. Look, none of this is my business. Forget it. Forget I asked about Jason Clary or Simon and Isabel.
You didn't ask about Simon and Isabel.
I didn't?
The side of his mouth quirked up.
Isabel was my first crush, you know.
Of course I know.
She threw the cap of her water bottle at him.
It was so obvious. You were staring at her at the party after Aline and Helen's wedding.
He ducked the bottle cap.
I was not.
You so were, she said. Do we need to talk about what we're looking for at Wells's place?
I think we should play by ear.
The quality of decision is like the well-timed swoop of a falcon, which enables it to strike and destroy its victim, said Emma. Julian looked at her incredulously. Is that a quote from The Art of War?
Maybe.
Emma felt a happiness so intense it was almost sorrow. She was with Jules, they were joking, everything was the way it should be between Parabatai. They had turned onto a series of residential streets. Wide mansions twined with flowers rose above high hedges, cocooned behind sweeping driveways.
"Are you being pithy? You know how I feel about pithiness in my car," Julian said.
"It's not your car."
"Either way, we're here," Jules said, pulling the car up to the curb and killing the engine.
It was twilight now, not quite full dark, and Emma could see Wells' house, looking like it had in the satellite photos on the computer. The peaks of the roof just rising over the massive wall that surrounded it, covered with draped trellises of bougainvillea. Julian hit the button that raised the car windows. Emma looked over at him.
"Just about dark. We worried about demonic activity."
He checked the glove compartment.
"Nothing on the sensor, but just to be sure, let's rune up."
"Okay." Emma pushed up her sleeves, holding out her bare arms as Julian drew the pale white, glimmering steely from his pocket. In the dark of the car, he leaned over, put the tip of the steely on her skin, and began to draw. Emma could feel his hair brush against her cheek and neck and smell the faint scent of cloves that hung around him. She looked down, and as the black lines of runes spread across her skin, Emma remembered what Christina had said about Jules. "He has nice hands." She wondered if she'd ever really looked at them before. Were they nice? They were Julian's hands. They were hands that painted and fought. They had never failed him. In that way, they were beautiful.
"All right."
Jules sat back, admiring his handiwork. Neat runes of precision and stealth, soundlessness and balance, decorated her forearms. Emma drew down her sleeves and reached for her own steely. He shivered when the steely touched his skin. "It must be cold."
"Sorry," Emma whispered, bracing her hand on his shoulder.
She could feel the edge of his collarbone under her thumb, the ribbed cotton of his T-shirt soft beneath her touch. She tightened her grip, her fingertips sliding against the bare skin at the edge of his collar. He drew in a sharp breath. She stopped.
"Did I hurt you?"
He shook his head. She couldn't see his face.
"I'm fine."
He reached behind himself and unlocked the driver's side door. A second later, he was out of the car and shrugging on his jacket. Emma followed him.
"But I didn't finish the sure strike rune."
He had moved around to the trunk and opened it. He took out his runed crossbow and handed her Cortana and its sheath.
"It's fine."
He closed the trunk. He didn't seem bothered. Same Julian, same calm smile. "Besides, I don't need it." He raised the crossbow casually and shot. The bolt flew through the air and plunged directly into the security camera over the gate. It blew apart with a whine of shattered metal and a wisp of smoke.
"Show off," Emma said, sheathing her sword.
"I'm your Parabatai. I have to show off occasionally. Otherwise no one would understand why you keep me around." An elderly couple appeared from a driveway near them, walking in Alsatian. Emma had to fight the urge to conceal Cortana, though she knew the weapon was glamored. To the mundanes walking by, she and Julian would look like ordinary teenagers, long sleeves concealing their runes. They passed around the corner of the road and out of sight. "I keep you around because I need an audience for my witty remarks," she said, as they reached the gates, and Jules took out his steely to draw an open rune. The gate popped open. Julian turned sideways to slide through the opening.
"What witty remarks?"
"Oh, you're going to pay for that," Emma muttered, following him. "I am incredibly witty." Julian chuckled. They had come to a lined pathway that led up to a large stucco house with enormous arch front doors, two huge panes of glass on either side. The lights lining the path were on, but the house was dark and silent. Emma sprang up the steps and peered in through one of the windows. She could see nothing but dark, smudged shapes.
"No one home. Oh!"
She jumped back a step as something flung itself against the window. A lumpy, hair-covered ball. Slime slicked the glass. Emma was already crouching, about to pull a stiletto from her boot.
"What is it?"
She straightened.
"A rom demon?
I think it's a mini-poodle," said Julian, the corner of his mouth twitching. "And I don't think it's armed," he added as she glanced down to stare accusingly at what was, yes, definitely a small dog, its face pressed to the glass.
"I'm almost positive, in fact."
Emma hit him on the shoulder, then drew an open rune on the door. There was the snapping click of the lock, and the door swung open. The dog left off licking the window and rushed out, barking. It darted around them in a circle, then lunged toward a fenced area at the far end of the yard. Julian darted off after the canine.
Emma followed him through the ankle-high grass. It was a nice garden, but nobody had taken real care of it. The plants were running wild, the flowered hedges overgrown. There was a pool, bordered by a waist-high ironwork fence, the gate hanging open. As Emma neared it, she could see that Julian was standing by the side of it, very still. It was the kind of pool that had LED lights in it, cycling through a rainbow of garish colors. Rows of pool chairs surrounded it, made of white metal with white cushions, dusted with fallen pine needles and blown jacaranda blossoms. Emma slowed as she reached the water. The dog was crouched by the pool ladder, not barking, but whimpering. At first, Emma thought she was looking at a shadow on the water. Then she realized it was a body. A dead woman in a white bikini floating on the surface of the pool. She was face down, long black hair drifting around her head, arms dangling at her sides. The purple glow from the pool lights made her skin look bruised.
"By the angel, Jules," Emma breathed. It wasn't as if Emma hadn't seen dead bodies before. She'd seen plenty. Mundanes, shadow hunters, murdered children in the Hall of Accords. Still, there was something plaintive about this body. The woman was tiny, so skinny you could see the lines of her spinal column. There was a splash of red against one of the pool chairs. Emma moved toward it, thinking it was blood, then realized it was a Valentino handbag made of bright red intaglio leather, slightly unzipped. A gold wallet had spilled out of it, and a pink phone. She glanced at the phone, then picked up the wallet and flicked through it.
"Her name's Ava Lee," she said. She was 22. "Home address listed as here. Must have been his girlfriend."
The dog whimpered again and lay down, his paws by the pool's edge.
"He thinks she's drowning," Julian said. "He wants us to save her."
"We couldn't have," Emma said softly. "Look at her phone. None of the calls have been answered in 2 days. I think she's been dead at least that long. We couldn't have done anything, Jules."
She put the wallet back in the bag. She was reaching for handles when she heard it, the click of a crossbow loading. Without looking or thinking, she threw herself at Jules, knocking him down. They hit the Spanish tile hard as a bolt whistled by them and vanished into the hedges. Julian kicked off against the ground and spun them over, rolling between two of the chairs. The phone Emma had been carrying flew out of her hand. She heard it hit the pool water with a splash and curse silently to herself. Julian levered himself up, his hands gripping her shoulders. His eyes were wild, his body pressing hers into the ground.
"Are you all right? Were you hit?"
"I wasn't. I'm fine," she gasped.
The dog was huddled by the fence, howling, as another bolt whistled down and struck the corpse in the pool. Ava's body flipped over, baring her swollen, drowning, blackened face to the night sky. One of her arms floated up, as if she were raising it to protect herself. With a brief flash of horror, Emma saw that her right hand was missing. Not just missing, but it looked as if it had been hacked away, the skin around her wrist ragged and bloodless in the chlorinated water. Emma rolled out from under Julian and sprang to her feet. There was a figure standing on the roof of the house. She could see it only in outline. Tall, most likely masculine, dressed in all black, crossbow in hand. He raised it and took aim. Another bolt whistled by. Rage settled over Emma, cold and hard. How dare he shoot at them? How dare he shoot at Jules? She took a running jump and cleared the pool. She hurtled over the gate and ran at the house, leaping up to seize hold of the wrought iron bars covering the lower windows. She levered herself higher, aware that Julian was shouting at her to get down, ignoring where the metal bit into her palms. She swung herself up, then up again, pushing off from the wall to flip herself onto the roof. The shingles crunched under her feet as she landed in a crouch. She looked up and caught a quick glimpse of the black-clad figure on the rooftop. He was backing away from her. His face was covered with a mask. Emma unsheathed Cortana. The blade glittered long and wicked in the dusk light. "What are you?" she demanded. "A vampire? Downworlder? Did you kill Ava Lee?" She took a step forward. The strange figure backed away. He moved without alarm, very deliberately, which only angered Emma more. There was a dead girl in the pool below them, and Emma had arrived too late to save her. Her body was thrumming with a desire to do something to fix it. Emma narrowed her eyes. "Listen up. I'm a shadow hunter. You can either surrender to the authority of the Clave, or I'll bury this blade into your heart. Your choice." He took a step toward her, and for a moment Emma thought it had worked. He was actually giving up. Then he dived suddenly to the side. She lunged forward as he tumbled backward off the roof,
He fell silently as a star. Emma cursed and ran to the edge of the roof. There was nothing. Silence, darkness, no sign of anything or anyone. She could see the glimmer of the pool. She moved around the side and saw Julian bending down, one of his hands on the dog's head. Trust Jules to try to comfort a puppy at a time like this. She braced herself and jumped. The image of the training room flashed behind her eyelids, landing in the overgrown grass with only a slight sting. "Jules," she said, coming closer. With a whimper, the dog darted away into the shadows. "He got away."
"Yeah?"
He straightened up, sounding preoccupied. "What do you think he was doing here?"
"I don't know. I guessed vampire, but Nightshade keeps a pretty tight leash on them, and..."
"Jules?" She heard her voice skip upward an octave as she drew close enough to see that he had one hand pressed against his side. His black ear jacket was torn.
"Jules, are you okay?"
He drew his hand away from his side. His palm was a welter of blood, black under the blue LED lighting of the pool.
"I'm fine," he said.
He rose to his feet and took a step toward her and stumbled.
"It's fine."
Her heart flipped over. He was holding something in his bloody hand, and her insides went cold as she saw what it was. A short metal crossbow bolt with a wide triangular head like an arrow, wet with blood. He must have pulled it from his side. You were never, never supposed to pull an arrow out of your skin. It did more damage coming out than going in. Julian knew that.
"What did you do?" Emma whispered. Her mouth had gone dry.
Blood was leaking steadily from the tear in his jacket.
"It was burning," he said. "Not like a normal arrow."
"Emma." He dropped to his knees. His expression was dazed, though he was clearly fighting it.
"We need to get out of here," he said hoarsely. "The shooter might come back. Alone or with more..."
His voice choked off and fell backward, sprawling in the grass. Emma moved faster than she ever had in her life, leaping across the pool, but she still wasn't there in time to catch him before he hit the ground. Clouds were gathering out over the ocean. The wind up on the roof was cool, the ocean acting like a giant air conditioner. Christina could hear the roar and crash of the surf in the distance as she moved gingerly across the shingles. What was it about the Blackthorns and Emma that meant that ever since she'd come to Los Angeles, she'd spent half her time on top of buildings? Mark was sitting near one of the copper gutters, his legs dangling over the side. The wind blew his fair hair around his face. His hands were long and white and bare, bracing him against the roof tiles behind him. He was holding one of the Institute's spare cell phones in his hand. It seemed incongruous, it was incongruous, the fairy boy with the long tangled hair, the tapestry of stars behind him, and the phone in his hand. "I'm so sorry, Helen," she heard him say, and the word echoed with such depth of love and loneliness that she nearly turned away. Leaving silently didn't seem to be an option, though. Mark had heard her approach. He turned slightly and gestured for Christina to remain. She hovered uncertainly. It was Drew who had told her that she could find Mark on the roof, and the others had urged her to go up and see if he was all right. She had wondered if it was really her place, but Ty and Livy had been absorbed in their translation job, and she'd sensed Drew was afraid of Mark's harsh words. And it wasn't as if Tavi could be sent to fetch his brother down. So with some reluctance, Christina had climbed a ladder to the roof. Now that she was here, though, she felt an aching sympathy for the boy perched at the roof's edge. The look on his face as he spoke to Helen, she couldn't imagine what it must be like for him, to know there was only one person in his family quite like him, who shared his blood and heritage, and to know she was separated from him by a cruel and unbreakable law. "And I you, my sister," Mark said, and let the phone fall from his hand. It was an old-fashioned one, with a screen that flickered and went dark as the call disconnected. He slid it into a pocket and looked over at Christina, the clouds casting shadows on his face. "If you've come to tell me I behaved ill, I already know it," he said. "That's not why I came," she said, moving closer to him but not sitting down. "But you agree," he said. "I behaved ill. I should not have spoken as I did to Julian, especially in front of the little ones." Christina spoke carefully. "I don't know Julian well, but I do believe he was worried about you, and that's why he didn't want you to go with them." "I know that," Mark said, surprising her. "But do you know what it's like to have your little brother worry about you as if you were the child?" He raked his fingers through his hair. "I thought, while I was gone, that Helen would be raising them. I never thought it would fall so much upon Julian's shoulders. I cannot tell if that is why he seems unknowable to me." Christina thought of Julian, of his quiet competence and careful smiles. She remembered saying to Emma in a joking way that perhaps she would fall in love with Julian when she met him. And he had been much more beautiful than she'd thought, than Emma's blurry photos or vague descriptions had led her to believe. But though she liked him, she doubted she could love him. Too much of him was hidden for that. "A great deal of him is, I think, locked away," she said. "Have you seen the mural on the wall of his room? The one of the fairy tale? He's like the castle, I think, surrounded by thorns that he has grown to protect himself. But with time, you can cut those thorns away. I believe you will know your brother again." "I don't know how much time I have," he said. "If we do not solve their puzzle, the Wild Hunt will reclaim me." "Do you want them to?" Christina asked softly. He said nothing, only glanced up at the sky. "Is that why you come up to the roof? Because from here you can see the hunt if they go by." Mark was silent for a long time. Then he said, "I imagine sometimes I can hear them, that I can hear the sound of their hooves against the clouds." She smiled. "I like the way you talk," she said. "It always sounds like poetry." "I speak the way I was taught by the folk. So many years under their tutelage." He turned his hands over and placed them on his knees, the insides of his wrists were marked by odd, long scars. "How many years, do you know?" He shrugged. "Time is not measured there as it is measured here. I could not say." "The years do not show on your face," she said quietly. "Sometimes you look as young as Julia, and sometimes you look as the Fae do, ageless." Now he looked at her sideways. "You don't think I look like a shadow hunter?" "Do you want to?" "I want to look like my family," he said. "I cannot have the blackthorn coloring, but I can look as much like Nephilim as possible. Julian was right. If I wish to be part of the investigation, I cannot stand out." Christina held back from telling Mark that there was no world in which he didn't stand out. "I can make you look like a shadow hunter, if you come downstairs with me." He moved as noiselessly on the shingled roof as if he had the padded feet of a cat, or as if he were wearing a soundless rune. He stepped aside to let her lead the way downstairs. Even that was hushed, and when she brushed by him, his skin was cool as night air. She led the way to his room. He had left the lights off, so she illuminated her witch light and set it down by the bed. "That chair," she said, pointing. "Bring it into the middle of the room and sit down. I'll be right back." He looked after her quizzically as she left the room. When she returned, carrying a damp comb, a towel, and a pair of scissors, he was seated in the chair, still with the same quizzical look. He didn't sit the way other teenage boys did, all sprawl and legs and arms. He sat the way kings did in drawings, upright but deliberate, as if the crown rested uneasily on his head. "Are you going to cut my throat?" he asked as she came toward him with the towel and the sharp scissors gleaming. "I'm going to cut your hair." She looped the towel around his neck and moved to stand behind him. His head tipped back to follow her movements as she took hold of his hair, running her fingers through it. It was the kind of hair that should have been curly but was weighed down by its own length and tangles. "Hold still," she said. "As my lady requests." She ran the comb through his hair and began to cut, careful to keep the length even. As she snipped away the weight of his silvery blonde mane, it sprang free in adorable curls like Julian's. They twined up against the back of his neck as if they wanted to be close to him. She remembered touching Diego's hair. It had been thick under her fingers, dark and textured. Mark's was fine, like corn silk. It fell like gleaming chaff, catching the witchlight. "Tell me about the fairy court," she said. "I've always heard stories. My mother told me some, and my uncle." "We didn't see it much," he said, sounding very ordinary for a moment. "Gwyn and the hunters aren't part of any court. He keeps himself to himself. We joined the courts and the gentry only on nights when there were revels. But those were..." He was silent for so long, she wondered if he had fallen asleep or was perhaps simply deathly bored. "If you had been to one, you would not forget it," he said. "Great sparkling caves or deserted copses and woodlands full of will-o'-the-wisp lights. There are still some parts of this world that are undiscovered by all but the folk. There was dancing to wear your feet down, and there were beautiful boys and girls, and kisses were cheaper than wine, but the wine was sweet and the fruit sweeter. And you would wake up in the morning, and it would all be gone. But you could still hear the music in your head." "I think I would find it very frightening." She moved around to stand in front of him. He looked up at her with his curious two-colored eyes, and she felt a tremor run through her hand.
one she never felt when she cut Diego's hair or his brother Jamie's, or any of her little cousins. Of course, they'd been 12 when she'd clipped their hair, showing off what her mother had taught her, so maybe it was different when you were older. Everything's so glamorous and beautiful. How can a human compare? He looked surprised. But you would be lovely in the court, he said. They would turn leaves and flowers into jeweled crowns and sandals for you. You would sparkle and be admired. The folk love nothing more than mortal beauty.
Because it fades, she said.
Yes, he admitted. It is true that eventually you will become gray and bent and withered, and it is possible that hair will sprout from your chin, and there is also the issue of warts. He caught her glare. But that time is a long time away, he added hastily. Christina snorted. I thought fairies were meant to be charming. She slid a hand under his chin to steady his head as she snipped away the last unruly strands. That was different, too. His skin was as smooth as hers, no hint of stubble or roughness. His eyes narrowed, their color thinning to a gleam as she set the scissors aside and cleared her throat. There, she said. Would you like to see? He straightened up in the chair. Christina was bending down, their heads were on a level. Lean closer, he said. For years I've had no mirror. I've learned to make do. The eyes of another can be a mirror more effective than water. If you look at me, I can see my reflection in yours. I've had to make do. Whose eyes had he been looking into all those years? Christina wondered as she leaned forward. She didn't know why she did it exactly. Maybe it was the way his eyes stayed fixed on hers, as if he couldn't imagine anything more fascinating than looking at her. His gaze didn't stray, either, not to the V of her shirt, or her bare legs, or even her hands, as she opened her eyes wide and looked directly back at him. Beautiful, he said finally. Do you mean your haircut? She asked, trying for a teasing voice, but it wobbled in the middle. Maybe she shouldn't have offered to so intimately touch a complete stranger, even if he did seem harmless, even if she hadn't meant anything by it, had she? No, he said on a soft exhale. She felt his breath warm on her neck, and his hand slid over hers. His was rough and calloused, scarred along the palm. Her heart gave an uneven leap in her chest, just as Mark's bedroom door opened. She nearly jumped away from him as Ty and Livy appeared in the doorway. Livy was holding her phone, and her eyes were wide and worried. "It's Emma," she said, lifting the phone. "She texted 911. We need to go meet them right away." 12. Stronger by far. Emma made a screeching right turn off Fairfax into a parking lot down the street from Cantor's Delicatessen. It belonged to a paint store that was closed now. She wheeled around to the back, where the lot was totally empty, and pulled the car to a jerking stop, making Jules swear. She looked back at him, unbuckling her belt. He was pale, clutching his side. She couldn't see much, given the darkness inside the car and the black clothes he was wearing, but blood was leaking through his fingers in slow pulses. Her stomach went cold. When he'd fallen at Wells's house, the first thing she'd done was sketch a healing rune on his skin. The second was get him to his feet and half-drag him, the weapons, and Ava's purse into the back seat of the car. It was only after they'd driven a few blocks that he'd moaned and she'd looked back to realize he was still bleeding. She'd pulled over and put on another healing rune, and then another. That would work. It had to. There were very few kinds of wounds that healing runes couldn't help. Those made by demon poisons, and those bad enough to kill you. She'd felt her brain hitch and freeze up at the thought of either of those possibilities, and had gone immediately for her phone. She texted Livy the first location she could think of that was familiar. They all knew and loved Cantor's, and then driven straight for it as fast as she could. She turned the car off with a jerk of her wrist and climbed into the back seat beside Jules. He was wedged into the corner, pale and sweating with obvious pain. "Okay," she said in a shaking voice. "You have to let me look at you." He was biting his lip. The streetlights from Fairfax illuminated the back seat, but not enough for Emma to see him well. He reached down for the hem of his shirt and hesitated. She took her witch light out of her pocket and lit it, filling the car with bright light. Jules's shirt was soaked with blood, and worse, the healing runes she'd drawn had vanished from his skin. They weren't working. "Jules," she said, "I have to call the Silent Brothers. They can help you. I have to." His eyes screwed shut with pain. "You can't," he said. "You know we can't call the Silent Brothers. They report directly to the Clave." "So we'll lie to them. Say it was a routine demon patrol. I'm calling," she said and reached for her phone. No, Julian said forcefully enough to stop her. Silent Brothers know when you're lying. They have the mortal sword, Emma. They'll find out about the investigation, about Mark. You're not going to bleed to death in a car for Mark.
No, he said, looking at her.
His eyes were eerily blue-green, the only deep color in the witch-lit interior of the car.
You're going to fix me.
Emma could feel it when Jules was hurt, like a splinter lodged under her skin. The physical pain didn't bother her. It was the terror, the only terror worse than her fear of the ocean, the fear of Jules being hurt, of him dying. She would give up anything, sustain any wound to prevent that from happening.
Okay, she said. Her voice sounded dry and thin to her own ears. Okay. She took a deep breath. Hang on.
She unzipped her jacket, threw it aside, leaned over the console between the seats to put her witch light on the floorboard. Then she reached for Jules. The next few seconds were a blur of Jules's blood on her hands and his harsh breathing as she pulled him partly upright, wedging him against the back door. He didn't make a sound as she moved him, but she could see him biting his lip and the blood on his mouth and chin. She felt as if her bones were popping inside her skin.
Your jacket, she said through gritted teeth. I have to cut it off.
He nodded, letting his head fall back. She reached for Cortana. Despite the toughness of the material, the blade went through the gear jacket like a knife through paper. It fell away in pieces. Emma sliced down the front of his T-shirt and pulled it apart as if she were peeling open a fruit. Emma had seen blood before, often, but this felt different. It was Julian's, and there seemed to be a lot of it. It was smeared up and down his chest and ribcage. She could see where the arrow had gone in and where the skin had torn when he yanked it out.
Why did you pull the arrow out? She demanded, pulling her sweater over her head. She had a tank top on under it.
She patted his chest and side with the sweater, absorbing as much of the blood as she could. Jules's breath was coming in harsh pants.
Because when someone shoots you with an arrow, he gasped, your immediate response is not, thanks for the arrow, I think I'll keep it for a while.
Good to know your sense of humor is intact.
Like I said, it was burning, Julian said. Not like a normal wound, like there was something on the arrowhead, acid or something.
Emma had mopped away as much of the blood as she could. It was still welling from the puncture wound, running in thin streams down his stomach, gathering in the lines between his abdominal muscles. He had deep gaps above his hip bones, too, and his sides were hard and smooth to the touch. She took a deep breath.
You're too skinny, she said as brightly as she could. Too much coffee, not enough pancakes. I hope they put that on my tombstone.
He gasped as she shifted forward, and she realized abruptly that she was squarely in Julian's lap, her knees around his hips. It was a bizarrely intimate position.
Am I hurting you? She asked.
He swallowed visibly.
Try with the Arazi again.
Fine, she said. Grab the panic bar.
The what?
He opened his eyes and peered at her. The plastic handle, up there above the window. She pointed. It's for grabbing onto when the car is going around curves.
Are you sure?
I always thought it was for hanging things on, he said, like dry cleaning.
Julian, now is not the time to be pedantic. Grab the bar, or I swear... All right.
He reached up, grabbed hold of it, and winced.
I'm ready.
She nodded and set Cortana aside, reaching for her steely. Maybe her previous Arazis had been too fast, too sloppy. She'd always focused on the physical aspects of shadow hunting, not the more mental and artistic ones, seeing through glamours, drawing runes. She set the tip of it to his shoulder and drew, carefully and slowly. She had to brace herself with her hand against his body. She tried to press as lightly as she could, but she could feel him tense under her fingers. The skin on his shoulder was smooth under her touch, and she wanted to get closer to him, put her hand over the wound on his side and heal it with the sheer force of her will.
Stop.
She had finished the Arazi. She sat back, her hand clamped around the steely. Julian straightened, the ragged remnants of his shirt hanging off his shoulders. He took a deep breath, glancing down at himself, and the Arazi faded back into his skin like black ice melting, spreading, being absorbed by the sea. He looked up at Emma. She could see her own reflection in his eyes. She looked wrecked, panicked, blood on her neck and her white tank top.
It hurts less, he whispered.
The wound pulsed again. Blood slid down the side of his ribcage, staining his leather belt and the waistband of his jeans. She put her hands on his bare skin, panic rising up inside her. His skin felt hot, too hot, fever hot.
You're lying, she said.
Jules, enough. I'm going to get help. She moved to climb off him, but his hand shot out and clamped over her wrist.
Em, he said. Emma, look at me.
She looked.
There was a little blood on his cheek, and his hair hung in sweaty dark curls, but otherwise